yet a good turnout of women to do nothing more sensational or more modern or more relevant than discussing the Bible itself. And after some weeks of worrying whether she could really give up at one monthly program, Dorothy got behind this beautifully, and it was her leadership, her time, which helped make it the success it is. And now to work. Last week, we got as far down in history as the Middle Bronze Age, which means that we're moving at a snail's pace down the corridors of time. And I frankly don't intend to pick up that pace much today. Looking ahead, I'd like to take you as far as the first Jewish experience of the Bible, the climactic and essential fact of the Exodus and Sinai. In other words, when this course ends, we're just at that point where Judaism really begins. And what we have done is really to give you a background with which to read the rest of the Bible, the bulk of the Bible itself. Last week we dealt primarily with the years 2000 to, say, 1500 BCE. And we saw during that lecture that our ancestors were wandering tribes people, probably of Western Semitic origin, that they, along with their wives and children, with their worldly goods laden on asses, walked the highways and the byways of the Fertile Crescent, which stretches, as you remember, from the Persian Gulf up the Tigris and Euphrates Valley, across to Syria, underneath what is today Turkey, and then down the Mediterranean coast into Egypt. And that our ancestors were only one of any number of these wandering tribes people who are well known to us from the documents at the time as Apiru, which we found was a status name, a legal description rather than ethnic description, which emphasized that these were men from outside the boundary, that these were men who had no stake in the land, who could not buy nor purchase land, men who earned their livelihood first off by trade, by offering their good right hand and sword as mercenaries, by selling their various skills to smiths or whatnot, and who were not above attacking a city if it looked to be an easy mark. We found that the word Ivri, the root of the word Hebrew, is derived from the same three-letter root as Apiru, and that our ancestors knew themselves to have been originally of this wandering stock. And we read together a few lines from chapter 14, I believe it was, in Genesis, in which we saw Abraham as the senior chief of a tribe, running off to the defense of one of the sub-chiefs of the clan, Lot, his nephew, who has been captured in war by a raiding party of petty Syrian kings who have overrun the city-state of Sodom, where Lot had a quasi-permanent trading center. And we saw Abraham in chapter 14 able to put in the field at a moment's notice some 300-plus armed and trained men and to effect the rescue of Lot, for a chief must always be responsible for the welfare of his tribe's people. What I'm suggesting to you then is that the usual Sunday school image of our fathers as smiling Bedouin walking behind flocks of sheep, the women kneading dough on their knees before a black-skinned tent with camels walking off in the distance, is a very inaccurate one. They were members of a far more sophisticated and far more cultured and far more commercial civilization. Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, insofar as we can make out the details of their lives, were the senior chiefs of far-ranging Hebrew clanspeople who were essentially merchant traders, who essentially inhabited the areas of the hill country and the Negev of Canaan of Palestine, and who came in time to have a rather permanent or semi-permanent relationship with this land rather than any other along the Fertile Crescent. Now, what of the men themselves? What do we know about Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and their wives and the like? We reviewed last week the rather extreme school of biblical criticism which assumes that these men are inventions, fictions made out of whole cloth, or at most that they represent tribes. They are the personification of tribes. There was an Abraham tribe, a Rachel tribe, a Leah tribe, and the like. And that these stories were simply made up to mask historical circumstance, what happened way back when in that early tribal days. Now there is no doubt that some of these stories do mask tribal events. There is a very ugly story in Genesis which tells of the rape of one of the daughters of Jacob, Dinah, by one of the local country people, a Hittite, and it tells that two of her brothers, Simon and Levi, went to her aid, and after a number of tricks played upon the local people, they massacred them one and all. Now, we know from later history that both Simon and Levi were punished for this act in the sense that they did not inherit specific lands. They seem to have disappeared largely from the face of history. And the tribe of Levi reappears much later as a group of minor attendants attached only to the temple shrine. What we apparently have in this story is a personification of a breach of faith by two tribes of Israel, against the expressed wish of their father, the senior tribes person, because what they did was to go in and to massacre the local people, therefore destroying the bonds of friendship, treaty, and trade which existed between them. And this was made up into this story which helped, presumably, to explain history to drive home the point. Does that mean that all of these stories are fictitious? Not at all. It simply means that some of them are. That we are not reading here attempts at complete biography. I would have you remember that the ancient historians had no qualms about quotation marks the way we do. 1,000 years after this historian, the most famous of the Greek writers, Herodotus and Thucydides, will put whole speeches into the mouths of Miltiades or of Pericles or of Alcibiades. Why? Because these speeches help them to dramatize the forces at work, the issues being acted about and on. And they had their hope as historians was to make history come alive rather than to deaden it, as do so many of our modern, very scrupulously truthful and accurate people. So the ancients had no qualms about inventing speeches if to do so meant that they helped to dramatize what had indeed happened. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, then, in my humble opinion, were real human beings. And we saw that there were stories about these men which could have taken place only in the times described. Remember the story of Abraham going down to Egypt and passing off Sarah as his sister. The Bible writer in the 10th century B.C. no longer understood what Abraham was saying. And he felt that he recalled to be a matter of shame that Abraham should be trying to pawn off Sarah, his wife, as his sister, apparently, he thought, as he read the story, to protect his own life. We saw that in the 15th, 16th century B.C. terms, the word sister didn't mean simply a sister, not a wife, but was a specific legal contract by which the first wife, the wife through whom inheritance passed in the tribe, was taken in wedlock in a special way. And that Abraham was not saying, I'm trying to hide the fact she is my wife. He was saying to the Pharaoh, according to the story, she is my first wife. Now, the later editor no longer understood this, and then he goes into a long invented story to explain God's outrage at Abraham's act, Abraham's punishment, the Pharaoh's punishment for taking Sarah, and the like. Now, let's move down a little bit from this early age, an age in which our ancestors lived, were merchants, tradespeople, shepherd people, sophisticated people, living in and among tradespeople, city people, and sophisticated people, but an age about which we can reconstruct very little, down from 3 centuries to the period of the Exodus itself. I'll try and defend this later, but accept it now as a statement. The Exodus probably took place between the year 1300 BCE and the year 1250 BCE, which means we're now in the late Bronze Age, the early Iron Age, and we are now at the events which are climactic in the history of Jewish life. You recall in Deuteronomy 26, which we've read twice, the statement made by our fathers on Sukkot, when they brought the first fruits to the sanctuary. The statement is a very simple one, which begins, "A wandering Aramean, a wandering tradesman, was my father," and then it goes right on. "And he went down into Egypt, and all these things happened to him in Egypt, and Moses brought him out of Egypt," and this is obviously the focus of events. They dismissed, in other words, the patriarchal period with a shrug of the shoulders. There were Hebrews. There were ancestors, but religiously, spiritually, these are not the climactic events. Indeed, the founding trinity of ideas in Jewish life all relate to Egypt. Bondage, freedom, responsibility under freedom. The Exodus, the going into Egypt, the Exodus, the going out of Egypt, and Sinai, the binding of our people to a covenant, a set of commandments. And almost everything in the Bible, almost everything in Jewish life, was made to relate to these three basic elements in our faith. In ancient times, the high holidays, which we consider to be Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, were not Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. In fact, for the first 400 or 500 years of Jewish life, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur did not even exist. There were the three pilgrimage festivals, Passover, Shavuos, and Sukkot. Each of these festivals was originally agricultural and has a history which goes far beyond Hebrew history. But the Jews took these over and made each of them relate not to any episode in Abraham's time or Isaac's time, but to episodes in Moses' time. Passover was the rehearsal of the going out of Egypt. Shavuos became the holiday which celebrated the giving of the law to Moses at Mount Sinai. Sukkot became the holiday was commemorated the dwelling in the temporary booth during the wandering in the desert. All of these three historical associations were artificial, but the important thing is that they were made. God is defined in terms of, "I am the Lord thy God who brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage." That's our first commandment. Not, "I am the Lord thy God who created the heavens and the earth." Or not, "I am the Lord thy God who created man and woman." Or not, "I am the Lord thy God who brought Abraham out of the paganism of Ur." But, "I am the Lord thy God who brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage." Now, what was there so critical about these three events? In the first place, they seem to have given Israel, for the first time, an identity. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob are not essentially dissimilar in their ideas, in their religious practices, in their way of life from the people among whom they live. They have a God with whom they have a covenant, Adonai, Yahweh, whatever he was called, El. Other people had covenants with a God who was presumably the senior God of the heavens. There were Apiro or Ivri, and there were tens of hundreds of these wandering tribes throughout the area. But once Moses comes along, and once the Jews have felt the oppression, the bondage of Egypt, once they have felt that they have no hope and are miraculously saved, and Moses, by the force of his personality, transforms this enthusiasm for the God into a new religious orientation, which is symbolized by the Ten Commandments. Once this happens, Jewish life becomes Jewish life. It becomes something definable. It becomes something that is different than the world about. They're no longer Apiru, they're now Israel. They're no longer the landless, they are now the possessors of a covenant. Now, their way of life, a way of religious thought, at 1250 or so, was not ours today. If Moses were to come down to the temple today, he would shake his head in disbelief at many of the things that we do. And we would wonder at some of the things that he might want to have done. After all, they offered animal sacrifices, and we no longer consider that to be an important element of religious life. But it is crucial that this sense of having been worth little, having been a slave people, and having suddenly been freed, and sensing a response that God freed them, the miracle, and the use of this miracle to forge the bands of a covenant, this remains the key element in our religious life to this day. Now, let's go over a little bit of detail, then, the going down and the going out. What happened? How much of it is history? How much of what the Bible tells us about it is history? I'd like to, first of all, give you a little bit of an historical schema of the world at this time. We saw, first off, that during the second half of the second millennium before the Common Era, these Hapiru wandered rather easily across the whole length and breadth of the Fertile Crescent. When we get to the Joseph story, the story of the going down into Egypt, when we get into the Moses story, the story of the going out, what happens from Syria east disappears from the biblical perspective. It's as if Persia, Iraq, Iran, what was then Babylonian Assyria no longer exist. And we know now some of the reasons for this. In the 16th century before the Common Era, two great tribes people came down out of the Turkish, the Anatolian highlands, and began to establish empires that stood athwart in the middle of the Fertile Crescent. First, a people known as the Mitanni, and then the people known as the Hittites. And these people effectively interrupted trade. At the same time that the old Babylonian kingdom of Hammurabi was torn by dissension from within, and on the other side of the Fertile Crescent, the kingdom of Egypt was being taken over by other of these hill warriors, the Hyksos, who ruled it for two centuries on their own. So we have a period of disruption, and we have a period in which it is very likely that Jewish life, that Hebrew life, no longer flowed the whole breadth and length, but concerned itself only with Egypt itself. Now, these Hyksos are a strange people. They come into Egypt around the year 1720 before the Common Era, and they remain as lords of Egypt till about the year 1530. The Hyksos remind me very much of the Normans of our own European history. You note in the 8th, 9th, and 10th centuries, the peoples of Scandinavia all of a sudden began to take their long boats, and they would be found at harbors as far west as Vineland, as Greenland, and the American shores, as far south as Dakar in Central Africa, as far east as Palestine and Egypt. The Normans, coming from this bare and bleak climate, conquered first off Denmark, the northern seacoast towns of Germany, all of the lowlands, all of France. From France, they conquered England. From England, they conquered Sicily, Crete, northern Italy, southern Italy. Then they established the great Crusader kingdoms in Palestine itself. All of a sudden, you get an eruption of a rather wild, violent group known by many names, Northmen, the Vikings, and the like, who are good warriors and have nothing to lose. They leave their women and children and their chattel behind. They go out and conquer, and they take new women and children and chattel where they manage to settle. And so it was with the Hyksos. These people come down out of the Anatolian hills. They come down just the men. They have very effective war chariots. They have trained horses to lead these chariots for the first time. They develop what's known as a composite bow. It's a forerunner of the European longbow. They conquer Egypt. The one and only time that Egypt was conquered from the outside in ancient history. And they rule Egypt for two centuries. Egypt then comes back to its own. Egypt has always been two kingdoms, an upper kingdom and a lower kingdom. And the pharaohs of the upper kingdom, at the headwaters of the Nile near the Sudan, come down and under a pharaoh named Anosis, reconquer Egypt, and there begins then around 1530 what's known as the Great Egyptian Age of Empire. This is the age that you see whenever you see an Egyptian historical display in a museum. This is the age of the treasure of King Tut. This is the age of the Great Pyramid building. This is the age of that wonderful swan-necked, high-foreheaded statue of Queen Hatshepsut that you always somehow see. This is the age when the Temple of Karnak was built with its magnificent leaved columns that come up and hold this gigantic building. Egypt ruled what was tantamount to all of Libya, all of the Sudan, all of Egypt, Ethiopia, all of Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, to the Turkish border. It was a powerful, rich, civilized state. And the nomads, the Bedouin people, and the Abiru people would come constantly into contact with this general sovereignty. Now, this Egyptian world, which we know much, left its imprint on the Bible and on Bible events, which are depicted from the 15th century down to the Exodus. You know that the religion of the Egyptians was polytheistic. It was complicated. It was conducted at temple centers. There were powerful priesthoods who had powerful and rich endowments. They offered sacrifices of all kinds. There was sorcery and magic as usual. But most of all, and uniquely, the Egyptian faith was centered on immortality, physical resurrection. And the pharaohs literally buried the national wealth of Egypt in the ground, in the great burial chambers for their pharaohs and for their noble people. And you know of embalming and the many caskets in which the people were finally put, and how all of their earthly possessions were buried beside them in the complicated rites and the like. Now you also know that in Jewish life, we bury simply, we bury immediately, we bury in a simple pine coffin traditionally. When Moses dies, the great Jewish hero of the Bible, Moses is buried in an unknown grave without any significant funeral rites at all, and that's it. And that's been the traditional Jewish way. Life belongs to the living. God will protect and take care, and we leave to God that which is of God. But I would like you to turn to Genesis chapter 50. This is the story of the death of Jacob after he has been reconciled with his son Joseph, who is now the vizier, the second in command to the Pharaoh. And Joseph fell upon his father's face and wept upon him and kissed him. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. Embalming, by the way, is outlawed in Orthodox Jewish life. And 40 days were fulfilled to him. And these are the days of embalming. And the Egyptians wept for him 70 days. And when the days of weeping for him were past, Joseph spoke unto the house of Pharaoh, saying, If now I have found favor in your eyes, speak, I pray you, in the ears of Pharaoh, saying, My father made me swear, saying, Lo, I die. In my grave which I have digged for me in the land of Canaan, there thou shalt bury me. Now therefore let me go up, I pray thee, and bury my father, and I will come back. And Pharaoh said, Go up and bury thy father according as he made thee swear. And Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his house, and all the elders of the land of Egypt. And all the house of Joseph and of his brothers and his father's house, only the little ones and their flocks and their herds they left in the land of Goshen. And there went up with him both chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great company. And they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, and there they wailed a very great and sore wailing, and he made a mourning for his father 7 days. And when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning in the floor of Atad, they said, This is a grievous mourning by the Egyptians. Wherefore, the name of it was called Avil Mitzrayim, which is just the Hebrew translation of that, which is beyond the Jordan. And his sons did unto him according as he had commanded them. Now, this is an exact description of Egyptian funeral rites. The embalming process, which was a very complicated and chemical one, took traditionally, according to Diodorus, who was a Greek traveler who watched some of this, between 30 and 40 days. We know from the Book of the Dead, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, that when a pharaoh died, his funeral rites occupied 72 days. The Bible here tells us 70. And we have long descriptions of the funeral ship, which was taken up the Nile with the pharaoh's four or five caskets inside, with all of his wealthy possessions that were going to be buried with him, to the port, which was of the pyramid, which is right on the Nile itself. And all the elders of Egypt and all the princes of the land would make ceremonial procession. Now, the Bible writer has described Egyptian funeral rites exactly with one change. He's had to put Jacob back into the land of Canaan. And so instead of being a ship on the Nile, they have the ship of the desert with his great funeral procession carrying the body, the embalmed body of Jacob back to Canaan. Well, here you have then one of the impresses of Egyptian life in this period in which Egypt ruled Canaan, Egypt ruled whatever lands the Jews lived in. The same thing, by the way, will happen to Joseph. Joseph orders his body to be embalmed, and later when Moses takes the Jews out, according to the story, they take the casket of Joseph back with him, and if you remember the movie, Mr. Cecil B. DeMille had a great deal of fun with that. Now, there are other indications of Egyptian influence. In other words, there are other indications that these stories have a certain degree of accuracy. The name of Moses. The word Moshe in Egyptian, I'm sure I'm not pronouncing it correctly, because no one knows how Egyptian was pronounced 4,000 years ago, means the begotten one. The king Pharaoh Tutmoshe, Tutmosis, as we call him, means he who is begotten of Tut, who was one of the Egyptian gods. So Moses was originally an Egyptian name. The Jews didn't know, had lost the understanding of this Egyptian root, and the Bible explains it as he who is drawn out of. And they have to invent the complicated story of the cradle being tossed about in the waters of the Nile to explain the name that Moses is given finally in the court of Pharaoh. But it's an Egyptian name. The name of the two midwives who, according to the Bible, saved the Jewish boys. The one is called Shifra and the other is called Pua. These names have no meaning in Hebrew, but both names have been found in Egyptian texts from this period of time. So we have indication of a prolonged stay by Jewish elements or Hebrew elements in Egypt. We also see this in the way in which the Exodus story in its legendary form is finally told. When God tells Moses, according to the legend, to go back into Egypt, Moses says, "What will you send with me that will give me power, that will make the Pharaoh listen to me?" In other words, how am I going to get in the door? I need a letter of introduction. Well, God couldn't write a letter of introduction, so he said, "Take your staff and throw it on the ground." And the staff becomes a snake. And he says, "Grab the snake by the tail," and the snake becomes a staff again. And then God says to him, "Put your hand in your vest." And he puts the hand in his garment, and he takes it out, and it's white with leprosy. And he says, "Now put your hand in your garment again." And he does, he takes it out, and his hand is clean and whole. Now the sorcerers and magicians of Egypt are famous. And apparently the Bible wanted to tell a story where we would one-up them. In other words, we would outdo them at their own skills. If you turn to chapter 7 of Exodus, you find that this one-upsmanship is taken to rather ridiculous extremes. Chapter 7 of Exodus, the second book of the Bible, beginning in verse 8. "And the Lord spoke unto Moses and to Aaron, saying, When Pharaoh shall speak unto you, saying, Show a wonder for you, then thou shalt say unto Aaron, Take thy rod and cast it down before Pharaoh, that it become a serpent. And Moses and Aaron went in unto Pharaoh, and they did so, as the Lord had commanded. And Aaron cast down his rod before Pharaoh and before his servants, and it became a serpent. Then Pharaoh also called for the wise men and the sorcerers, and they also, the magicians of Egypt, did in like manner with their secret arts. For they cast down every man his rod, and each became a serpent. But Aaron's rod swallowed up their rod." My daddy is stronger than your daddy. The Bible, of course, is filled with all manner of law which prohibits magic, divination, sorcery, and the like to the Jews. And so this kind of a legend is obviously designed to return to the Egyptians their own on their own terms. But it draws definitely on this Egyptian kind of background. Now, all Egyptian influence on Jewish life is not negative and banal. The Egyptians had, as I said, a high degree of civilization. And they had a high religion, considering the polytheistic elements of the time in certain respects. One of these, their cults, was a cult of the god Aten. The god Aten is a sun god who was worshipped as a solar disk. You may have seen images of it. There's a bright piece of metal with hands reaching out from the rays of the sun, and each hand holds a serpent in it. The god can sting, the god has power, but he's essentially the life-giving power of the sun. Now, in the 14th century, a young man came to the throne of Egypt by the name of Amenhotep IV. He came to the throne at the age of 19. He died before he was 26. So he didn't rule very long. What we can tell of this young man, this young pharaoh, is that he was a religious fanatic. He was very much caught up with and involved in the religious elements of his time, that he worshipped the god Aten, this sun god, that he changed his name, in fact, to Ikhnaten, after his god, and that he went after the major sanctuaries of the other major god, Amun-Re, and that he pulled down these sanctuaries, that he left Thebes, which was his capital, a city dedicated to Amun-Re, and that he, in fact, established a new capital for Egypt at a place called Tel El Amarna. Now, Ikhnaten brought about then a revolution in the polytheistic practices of Egypt on two counts. The first, he insisted that his god alone was a supreme god. We call this monolatry. It does not mean that there could not be lesser gods, but this god alone has power. And he also said all the magical, the dark things which take place in the inside of the temple must be avoided. And he brought worship out into the open. It had to be out in the open, in an open temple court, so that all might see and might take part, and so that it would be closer to his own patron god, Aten. Now this is an amazing religious revolution. It takes religion out of the level of sorcery, witchcraft, the using of incantations and spells to make the god do what you want, and it becomes the focus of the national life of the people. And we have from the Tel El Amarna inscriptions from this new capital which he built, some of the hymns which were written by priests of the time, or perhaps by this young man himself, Ikhnaten, to the god Aten, which are high in quality and fine in spirit. And perhaps so that we don't come to believe that all virtue, wisdom, creativity, and spirit belongs to our people. Let me read you a few verses. This is 100 years before Moses. Thou dost appear beautiful on the horizon of heaven, O living Aten, thou who wast the first to live. When thou hast risen on the eastern horizon, thou hast filled every land with thy beauty. Thou art fair, great, dazzling, high above every land. Thy rays encompass the lands to the very limit of all that thou hast made. Being rare, thou dost reach to their limit and curb them for thy beloved son. Though thou art distant, thy rays are upon the earth, thou art in their faces, yet thy movements are unknown. When thou dost set on the western horizon, the earth is in darkness, resembling death. Men sleep in the bedchamber with their heads covered, nor does one eye behold the other. For all their gods, their goods stolen, which are beneath their heads, they would not be aware of it. Every lion has come forth from his den, all the snakes bite. Darkness prevails, and the earth is in silence, since he who made them is resting in his horizon. At daybreak, when thou dost rise on the horizon, thou dost shine as Aten by day. Thou dost dispel the darkness and shed thy rays. The two lands, Egypt, is in a festive mood, awake and standing on their feet. For thou hast raised them up. They cleanse their bodies and take their garments. Their arms are lifted in adoration at thine appearing. The whole land performs its labor. All beasts are satisfied with their pasture. Trees and plants are verdant. The birds which fly from their nests, Their wings are spread in adoration to thy soul. All flocks skip about on their feet. All that fly up in the light live when thou hast risen for them. Ships sail upstream and downstream alike, for every route is open at thine appearing. The fish in the river leap before thee, for thy rays are in the midst of the sea. That's good poetry. And it's an image, religiously, of a God who is supreme in the cosmic sense, in heaven, whose force is imaged as that of the basic life-giving spirit of the sun. Now, there are those who have argued, biblical critics, Mr. Freud and a few others, that Moses gone off every idea he had from Ikhnaton. There are certain problems, however, to this belief. First of all, the reformation of Ikhnaton lasted only 5-6 years. When his successor came to power, Tel Amarna was deserted. The god Aten was reduced to a second level of in the heavens. All the other priests reasserted their ancient prerogatives. Rites were taken back into the dark places of the temple. And Egypt never again in all of its history came to a position where Ikhnaton had taken it to, a belief in the oneness, the one power supreme. Moses lived 100 years later. Did he know of this? We do not know. We also know that even though Ikhnaton worshipped Aten as the one god, he insisted that he be worshipped as a god. But have we a monotheism here? It's questionable. In addition to this, we know that from the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries before the Common Era, many of these West Semitic peoples had come to monolatry, to an idea of a supreme god to whom all other gods must be subservient if they are believed at all. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. There's almost that principle. It doesn't say there are no other gods. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. And we certainly, this principle was certainly enunciated before Jewish life became Jewish life. It's here, in the hymn of the son of Ikhnaton. We find it hundreds of years before among some of the West Semitic peoples. The Jewish contribution was to go one step further. They say not only there are no other gods before me, but I am the Lord. There are no other gods. What I'm trying to get at is a simple proposition that religious creativity is never a unique thing. It doesn't belong to any one people. And the test of one's religious significance doesn't necessarily lie in who had the idea first, but in what group made the most of it and was able to teach it to subsequent generations. Monolatry was a fossil development in Egypt. It never went further than this little period of time. The West Semitic peoples died, and we have no trace of their faith. It was only Israel which took this idea, embroidered it, developed it, refined it, which passed it on to the Western world and to Western civilization. Well, enough has been said, I think, about the kind of world in which the Jews were living this period to try and get us into the Jews who lived there themselves, to talk a little bit about history. Now, I want to give you the scheme of what I'm going to try and say. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob come as these wandering people to the Holy Land, to Canaan. And they come as mercenaries, they come as craftsmen, it's one thing or another, and some of them settle. And I'm going to suggest to you today that not all of those who settled, not all of the Hebrews who settled in Canaan went down to Egypt. That not all Jews took part in the Exodus. But this was limited to certain tribes, to certain people. And I can't tell you who they were, but I'll tell you the reasons why I want you to keep this scheme in mind. In the first place, in the book of Judges and the book of Joshua, which describes the conquest of the Holy Land, we learn in addition to the legendary stories how the walls blew, Jericho blew down when Joshua blew his horns about them, which seems to talk of a single, direct, and immediate conquest of Canaan. It actually took several hundred of years. It was a piecemeal thing. And very often during this, we find Jews fighting against Jews. We find Jewish tribes fighting with the local people against the tribes who are being brought over from across the Jordan under Moses, under Joshua, Caleb, and the other leaders. It would seem to be that these settlers who remained were of an old Hebrew stock who had so assimilated, so identified, that they no longer feel themselves a part of the earlier experience. And I think this explains, too, in part, why Israel broke up into not only separate tribes, but two separate kingdoms later on. Next year, the year after, whenever we get down to the 8th century, before the Common Era, we'll see that there are two very definite religious traditions, one belonging to the Northern Kingdom, one belonging to the Southern Kingdom, one which makes much of Moses, one which makes much of Aaron, one which makes much of Sinai, one which makes much more of David and Solomon as the founders of the kingdom. In any case, I want to suggest to you that not all Jews went down into Egypt, and that Moses didn't take all Jews up out of Egypt. Now, I'd like you to turn to Genesis chapter 23. This is a lovely story. This delicate, sensitive story, apparently, of how, when Sarah dies, the local people who have no tribe relationship with Abraham allow him, at his own named price, seemingly for a pittance, to buy a burial plot, a grave in Mayfield Cemetery, for her. And the life of Sarah was 120 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. And Sarah died in Kiryat Arba, the same as Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. And Abraham rose up from before his dead and spoke unto the children of Heth, saying, I am a stranger and a sojourner with you. Give me a possession of a burying place with you, that I may bury my dead out of my sight. And the children of Heth answered Abraham, saying to him, Heareth, my lord, thou art a mighty prince among us. In the choice of our sepulchres bury thy dead. None of us shall withhold from thee his sepulchre, but that thou mayest bury thy dead. And Abraham rose up and bowed down to the people of the land, even to the children of Heth, and he spoke to them, saying, If it be your mind that I should bury my dead out of my sight, hear me, and entreat for me of Ephron the son of Zohar, that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he hath, which is in the end of his field, for the full price let him give it to me in the midst of you for a possession of a burying place. Now Ephron was sitting in the midst of the children of Heth, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the children of Heth, even of all that went in at the gate of his city, saying, Nay, my lord, hear me. The field give I thee, and the cave that is therein I give it thee. In the presence of the sons of my people give I it thee. Bury thy dead. And Abraham bowed down before the people of the land. He spoke unto Ephron, saying, But if thou wilt, I pray thee, hear me, I will give the price of the field. Take it of me, and I will bury my dead there. And Ephron answered Abraham, saying unto him, My lord, hearken unto me. A piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver, what is that betwixt me and thee? Bury therefore thy dead. And Abraham hearkened unto Ephron. And Abraham weighed to Ephron the silver which he had named in the hearing of the children of Heth, 400 shekels of silver, current money with the merchant. So the field of Ephron which was in Machpelah, which was before Mamre, the field and the cave which was therein, and all the trees that were in the field, that were in all the border thereof, round about, were made sure unto Abraham for a possession in the presence of the children of Heth, before all that went in at the gate of his city. Now it sounds on the surface like a morality story, designed to impress the point that when a person is in grief and mourning, you should go out of your way to be helpful and considerate to them. And that Ephron did everything he could and more to be gentle with and generous with Abraham, and he gave him for a pittance the burial place which he specifically requested. Now, nothing I'm going to say now should make you assume that I don't believe the moral of the story to be true. But the story simply doesn't hang true from what we know historically. The phrase, current money with the merchant, is our term. It appears in many cuneiform tablets. And we know the value of the coin involved. And we know also that the 400 pieces of coin, which he names as the price for this cave, would lead us to the fact that Abraham is buying a small, obviously a cave and a small piece of land before it, for a fantastic sum. It's as if he were paying for a piece of property worth $10,000, $100,000. So we don't have here from the surface, the minute we know that, a story of a bargain among grieving friends. What have we? But we seem to have a very carefully worded legal document. No loopholes. Lawyer language. Look at 17 and 18, which defines every jot and tittle of land involved in the sale of Machpelah. The trees. The border was made sure. And it was done publicly. And we know this legal form because we found it in many of the land grants, the mortgage title searches of cuneiform tablets from Hur, from Ugarit, and from other places in the area. So again, there's a formality to this. There's a sense of an arm's length contract, which would gainsay the first feeling of the story. Let's put it together then as we unravel it. In the first place, Abraham as an apiru could not purchase land. This was the way in which the local peoples protected themselves from these predators. They were allowed, if they could pass an admissions test, to purchase land. And what was the admissions test? The public meeting of the city-state where they wanted to purchase land. We don't know what the blackball procedures were, but it was very much like the admission to an American fraternity or club. The possession of land gave you a permanent residence, gave you rights, legal and economic, which Abraham as an apiru lacked. Abraham, in other words, used the death of his wife to make a public appeal for admissions to the people of Heth for the right to be of them and among them and to have a stake, an anchor. He was no longer a landless person. And Ephron made him pay through the nose. But he got the land. And the importance of this little cave comes back time and again. Every one of the great patriarchs is buried there. Jacob insists that his body be brought back all the way from Egypt there. Why? This apparently was the first claim the Jews had to Canaan, their first legal title. Given more, just as wanderers, they had no title. But now they have been admitted. They had as much right here as anyone else. And we have a similar story told about another piece of land as far as Jacob is concerned later on in the Bible. What we have here is an indication, then, that the Jews owned land, the Hebrews owned land in Canaan long before the desert experience. We have also an indication that they fought for land. I told you the story of Dinah, Simeon, and Levi. So back in the 18th and 17th and 16th centuries, we know of large-scale settlements. We know that Abraham put 300-plus armed men in the field. Now put all this together with what Exodus 1, the first chapter of Exodus, tells us about the going down to Egypt, and we get a strange picture. Because Exodus 1 tells us, if you look at it, that only 70 men and all the souls that came out of the loins of Jacob were 70 souls. These are the people who went down to Egypt. Only 70 men went down with Jacob to Egypt. There must have been far larger settlements in Canaan. And these must have remained during whatever was the period of the Egyptian experience. Well, having established this, when did the Jews go down? When did Jacob, the Jews, go down into Egypt? The Bible tells us in Exodus in chapter 12, and one highly legendary source, that the Jews were in Egypt for 430 years. If we accept for the time being the date of 1250 or 1300, this puts us back into the 17th century, maybe the 18th century before the Common Era. This is patently too early. A small group would assimilate over 400 years of time, as always happened in Jewish history. They had no identity as yet. They had nothing to hold them together. There's another indication that we were for a much shorter period in Canaan. If you turn to Genesis chapter 14, you find a strange little bit of information buried in the text. Wait a minute, am I right? It's 14. Genesis 15, I'm sorry. God is making a promise here to what will happen, and the promise is obviously made long after the thing has happened. In verse 13, And God said to Abraham, Know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them for 400 years. Well, here you get one text. Go on. And also that nation they shall serve will I judge, and afterward shall they come out with great substance. Thou shalt go to thy father in peace. Thou shalt be buried in a good old age. And in the fourth generation they shall come back hither, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet full. Here we have tradition that says four generations, 80 years, 70 years, 90 years, was the length of the stay of the Jews in Egypt. It's really an academic point, because the Bible doesn't tell us a single fact or give us a single line as to what happened during this prolonged period of time. Slavery never makes history. But it is interesting to try and place these things historically. I would accept the four generations as a much more workable figure than the 430 years. And in fact, we can explain why they came to 430 years. Because that same very legendary source tells us that when the Jews left Egypt, 605,552 men, not counting the women and children and the Levites, went up with Moses. Now, you'd have to be quite fecund rabbits in four generations to have multiplied 70 people into 605,000, etc. He obviously needed a longer breeding season. But the why did the Jews go down? For obvious reasons, for grain and for water. Palestine depends on the rainfall. The great gods of Palestine were always the rain gods. There's still rain prayers in our traditional liturgy. Egypt is free of dependence upon the rain. The Nile overflows every year and brings down all the silt and all the rich topland of the mountains of Uganda and of the Sudan. So Egypt was always a rich and fertile land, and when they could no longer pasture in the free and open pastures of the hill country of Judea, the nomads came down into Egypt. And Egypt had a regular procedure. There was an area of land which the Bible calls Goshen. Egyptians had other names for it, which was lowland, which could not be cultivated. It is now land which is cut through by the Suez Canal. It's precisely that area, where the people were allowed to come and to rent pasturage for a year or so at a certain price. We found a piece of papyrus written in the 13th century before the Common Era, about this time, by a lieutenant on the border between Egypt and the Sinai wilderness, who writes back to his commanding officer that a group of Edomite herdsmen had just passed through with so many cattle, so many sheep, so many women, children. They're going to this pasture area, and they have paid him the toll and the passport tax and the visa tax and the rental for the land for 1 year, and he's going to forward it by military messenger back to headquarters. So there was a regular procedure, regular, well-traveled, well-planned, well-known procedures that brought the Jews down. Abraham is said to have gone down during a time of famine. Isaac went down. Jacob went down. And unfortunately, stayed. What happened? We don't know. Exodus 1 tells us two things, and it's our only source as to the events of these years. Beginning in verse 8. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who knew not Joseph, and he said unto his people, Behold, the people of the children of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply. It come to pass that when there befalleth us any war, they also join themselves unto our enemies, and fight against us, and get them up out of the land. Therefore they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. The two crucial elements in this paragraph are, first of all, a new king, and second of all, the words Pithom and Ramses. One explanation of a new king means not a new king, but a new dynasty. Josephus, the historian of the first century, explains it this way. He said that the Jews came in the Hyksos, who were Semites. When the Hyksos were overthrown, the Jews suffered and were reduced to slavery along with all the other attendants of this foreign rule. This is the new king, and all else flows from it. Perhaps. No other possible explanation would be any change of rule. Why are the words Pithom and Ramses important? Because we can locate Ramses. Ramses was a city in the Delta region built by the pharaoh Ramses II, who reigned from 1280 to 1224 as his capital and to his vanity. He named it after himself. And within 8 years of his death, the city was changed. Its name was changed. It is no longer referred to as Ramses. It's called, from that time, Avaris or Tanis. So any reference to Ramses can be only in the 13th century. And we know now, too, that something happened in that 13th century to this great Egyptian empire. And that is an incursion of people from the Mediterranean. When Troy fell, we can relate two great legends. At about that same time, a whole group of peoples began moving across the island regions. Sardinians, Cretan people, Mycenaean people, the people ultimately, the Minoans. And they came down about the year 1230 and attacked Egypt. And they were repulsed. They came down again about 1215 and attacked Egypt. And they were repulsed again, and this time they came up and they founded the Philistine Empire. The ones who were repulsed in the first attack spread out again into the Mediterranean, and they settled the great island kingdoms, Crete, Cyprus, the Delian League cities, and even went so far as Sicily and Sardinia. So it may be that this paragraph refers to a time after the first attack, when the Egyptians are weary. This almost threw the Egyptian Empire over, that a group of armed slaves within their borders might be a fifth column, and they'd better see to it that it doesn't happen to them. So we can date then the hard work that the Jews were put to doing during the 13th century. And this fits in with the one bit of extra biblical evidence we have. The king who followed Ramses was a man named Merneptah. He reigned for only 8 years. His father lived to be 94, and he was about 76 when he came to the throne. And he died of a good old age. He reigned for only 8 years. Merneptah left two great obelisks, two black steels, one at Karnak and one at Thebes. You've seen these big black meteorite stones, hard rock into which the ancients carved the records of their dynasties. And he says in there, at one point, talking about a campaign which he raged in the year 1220 in Canaan, "The people of Israel is laid waste, its seed is not. Palestine has become a widow for Egypt." So we know that by the year 1220, Israel must have been in Canaan. One might comment on the irony that the first reference to the Jews in all history is that we're no more. Others have said the same thing, and we somehow still are. Well, what is this? In all probability, it's hyperbole. The pharaohs love to claim great victories. It's like the communiques that some of our generals sent back during the Second World War. They had great victory after great victory during 1940 and 41, you'll recall, always moving backwards. Merneptah was a weak king, but in any case, this is a date in time which helps us fix the events of the Exodus. Now, you notice that today I spent very little time with the text itself, because very frankly, the story of the Exodus, leading up to the great events of Sinai, is Haggadah. It's myth, it's legend, it's pious fancy, it's richly embroidered. We don't know a single historical fact behind it. We do know events could not have been as they are described in the first chapters of Exodus. We do know that the historical imagination, the rather perfervid historical imagination, is at work. We can explain some of the elements. But it's very obvious that this is all later, written back, to explain something the Jews couldn't understand themselves. The miraculous exodus from Egypt. How did their ancestors get out? We don't know any more than they did. But they got out, seems to be sure. Now, what are some of the elements that we can explain? I spoke of the story of Moses and his name and the reason that he had the cradle tossing about the waters of the Nile. What about the story of the tenth plague? You know that God tells Moses that Pharaoh will be made to listen. And he says, now, each time he doesn't listen, we're going to get a little tougher with him. And we're going to call in the Better Business Bureau, and then we'll call in a lawyer, and then we'll call in, we'll haul him into court, so on and so on. The tenth plague is a plague that is to destroy the firstborn in each Egyptian home. And you know, the Jews, to escape from the angel of death, are to paint with the blood of the paschal sacrifice some mark on the lintel of their door, and the angel of death presumably will pass over. Now, what's the background of this? We know now that in the centuries long before the Exodus, among shepherd people, there was a holiday on the first full moon after the spring equinox, which was about lambing season, where there was a watch night on that full moon night, which was a taboo night, a fearful night. And God must be offered, whichever the God was, the first lamb from the flock of the new season's crop. That was your duty to God. And as a sign that you had performed that duty, these Bedouin people would take the blood of this sacrifice and would actually mark up the lintel of their doors. Now, this is not Jewish. This is common among Semitic shepherd people of the time. Somehow or other, the story of Passover got all of the Exodus got put into this ancient Passover holiday. And they wove the story of deliverance from Egypt into the story of the deliverance from Egypt, and God was then made, or the angel of death was then made to have taken that night the firstborn of the Egyptians and to have spared the firstborn of the Jews. Why the ten plagues themselves? The Egyptians had a literature which is called the literature of curses. All kinds of quasi-magical incantations which were designed to ward off all manners of diseases. We use doctors today. Sometimes I think we make curse when we get the bill, but they had the curses first. And spells, magical incantations and the like. One of their favorite curses involved 10 plagues. And the Jews apparently just took the symbol and turned it back on their own. Why, some other elements that we can explain. I jotted down a few here. You know, when the Jews left Egypt, they're said to have stolen gold, all the jewelry of the Egyptians that night. Why? Because later on in the desert, they have to have enough gold to make the golden calf. Where else would a group of exiles get the wherewithal in the middle of the desert? So we can put together some of the parts. We know, for instance, how matzah came to be involved in the Passover story. There is an old spring agricultural festival observed by most of the Canaanite peoples, where they took the first cuttings of the barley harvest, of the spring crop, and they baked this quickly into some kind of hardtack, matzah. And they offered this as to their god, and they would eat then this along with their sacrifice. Now, this holiday took place at the spring equinox. And this holiday, this matzah holiday, was tied in also with the Passover holiday later on. Bouillabaisse, which is our Exodus story. What we have here is a people who later went out in search of a way of celebrating the great event of their tradition, and they wove into it all manner of ancient practice. And it's hard sometimes to unravel it, but we can. How did, for instance, Thanksgiving? Thanksgiving is uniquely American. Yet if we were to trace it back, we'd find it's no more than the biblical Sukkot. When the Puritan fathers came over, they were determined to observe Sukkot. They observed all the biblical holidays. But they didn't know quite how to do it, and turkey was more available than a roast lamb, and they weren't sure roast lamb was required in the first place, and our growing season is different than it is in the ancient Near East. And we out of this, and Mr. Roosevelt's dating, we got to our present Thanksgiving. Now, the important thing really is not to unravel this thing historically, but it is to see that these first 15, 18 chapters of Exodus are a Haggadah. They are a late telling of events which no one could explain. It is more likely, if I were to try and
analyze Moses, I would give you this reconstruction. Moses probably was not born in Egypt at all. You know, his wife is a keen-eyed woman. He has his vision outside of Egypt. His father-in-law is not among the Hebrew tribes. He's a leader of the Kenite tribe. And there is he has children, although we never hear of them anymore. One's named Gershon, out in this desert. And he's one of the peoples, the Hebrew peoples, who is not part of the subjection, therefore a free man, therefore of the palace. Now, all the stories of palace birth and being raised in the Pharaoh's house and so on, these are traditional stories that people tell about their great heroes. After all, three wise men attended the birth of Jesus and so on. This is familiar. So he probably is a man who saw this subjection, saw an opportunity to bring the Jews out. What that opportunity was, we don't know. How they affected it, we don't know. And all probably a miraculous escape over some water route played some part. There are a number of bogs of one kind in the low-lying water areas near what is now Suez, and they were more or less connected with the Mediterranean. It may have been that one all of a sudden was flooded. Who knows? But they had a historical memory of some kind of miraculous escape. And then Moses' personality comes into its own in the desert. It is here that he binds the covenant. It is here that he welds a rabble into a people. It's here that he imposes a structure on the tribes. It's here that we get a full-blown Jewish life for the first time. So I would say to you that of all the history we've read so far, these first 19 chapters of Exodus are the least historical. They are pious imagination at best. And I don't think it matters much. Moses' role is not so much the liberator as the lawgiver. And the importance to the Jews was not how they got out, but that they got out. So this is legend, pure and simple. Now someday we can roll back the camera and I'm proved all wrong. I'll be delighted. But the story doesn't hang together, and it's too easy to pull this story apart and to see its historical base. Well, let me stop now and let you ask questions. I've been a little more technical and historical today than heretofore, but I think you're ready for it. Yes. Speak out or forever hold your peace. Yes.
Why do we teach our children the story of the unleavened bread? Like the fact that through the Exodus the bread did not have time to rise, it's proven untrue.
Well, first of all, it hasn't been proven untrue. We can't prove it. We can assume it to be untrue. Second of all, it's a good story. And it's a story which we had the same purpose with our kids that the Bible had in writing these 19 chapters. We want to emphasize the importance of these events. And this is a way of driving it home. Now, children will tell them another way. You know the famous story, don't you, of the child who came home from Sunday school and talked how the Jews fled from Egypt and Moses was followed, you know, by the Pharaoh's horsemen and so on, except he talked about the tanks and the half-tracks and the armored cars. Mother shook her head and wondered much. She says, "Is that the way you were told in Sunday school?" He said, "No, Mommy, but you wouldn't believe the way I was told." Henrietta?
In unraveling the story of Moses, we can go a little further and tell us how we think we received the Ten Commandments.
That's next year. I'll start out by saying that no competent biblical historian that I know of believes that Moses received the Ten Commandments as we know them. And after that shock sets in, we'll go on. There are three or four numberings of Ten Commandments in the Bible. There are two, one in Exodus and one in Deuteronomy, which are our classic ones, are slightly different. But it would seem that these are the latest of the covenant words. There's some argument which is the first. is probably Exodus chapters 21 through 23. How Moses received these laws, we don't know. Part of them we can trace earlier, to earlier law code. The religious ones seem to have been unique to Israel. What Sinai seems to have been originally was simply the place at which a symbolic ascent took place by the people to this new responsibility. A contract must be signed. When your husband and another man are in a business deal, they go to one or another office or to a lawyer's office, and there's a symbolic signing. Sinai is the symbolic assenting. The crucial words of Sinai are Naaseh v'nishma. We have heard and we will obey it. And that's what happened. And that's the symbol of Sinai is a symbol of this ascent. I cannot say to you that the Ten Commandments as we have them were the commandments that Moses received. In all probability, they were not. Although most of the laws of the Ten Commandments were basic social practice long before Moses. Murder, theft, adultery, these are the common rules of all mankind. But the precise enumeration, we can't accept on the basis of the Bible as we have it. Yes? This question, I think, goes to the basis of what I've been trying to get across to you in my own way these last 4 weeks. Somehow we feel the Bible must be holy, pure, wholly acceptable, and wholly moral in our terms. It is not. There are many things in the Bible which couldn't be accepted in the Bible's own times. Stone an adulterer, burn a witch, etc., among the laws. There are stories in the Bible which perhaps do not fit with our current state of morality. There's a law in the Bible, for instance, and on the seventh year, the Hebrew slave must be let free. Now, this is an advance because there was no mandatory freeing for any slave in any law code at any time until long after our own. But on the seventh year, there was mandatory freedom. We were obviously fighting against slavery. The Sabbath law is an anti-slavery law. One day in seven, the slave can call his soul his own. You can't work him. It's the original bit of labor legislation. But it's not enough for us, is it? Man must be free from the very beginning, and he must remain free, and there is to be no slavery. So we've gone morally far beyond the point at which the Bible could leave us, because there was no laboring class. There was no middle class in those days. You needed slave labor, in a sense, to keep the economy going. You had so little money in commercial exchange. So they went as far as they could. That doesn't mean we accept it, or we don't try and go further. And they had some strange rights associated with, let's say, slavery. If a man refused his freedom, they took him to the public square where all government business was contracted, and they pierced his ear with an awl. Now, you girls will know that this is not so serious. You do it yourselves, to yourselves, for cosmetic reasons. But what were they saying? They were saying that the ear which had heard God proclaim freedom and refused to accept its own freedom was somehow an imperfect ear and should be seen as such. It's an attempt to drive home that you must have the guts to stand up on your own two feet and to make your own way as best you can. Now, many prefer to be ordered about, to be guaranteed their three square meals a day and so on. And slavery, of course, was not a uniformly evil thing. Many were house slaves, tutors were slaves, the artists of the world were slaves, many of them, technically, though they had fine lives, many of them. So many of them didn't want to leave this, but the man's proper state is freedom. That's the idea behind this ancient and, to us, archaic and us, rather violent custom. But it was their world. So what am I saying to you about Jacob? I'm saying to you that they tell a story. that there are certain things we can find in this story, which are moral, there's certain things which are not. There's certain things which may fit my morality and not yours, or my code and not yours. To the Jew, I think these stories were simply, they emphasize the importance of reconciliation, the courage of struggling within yourself, and very much, I suspect, the same level of morality which Hollywood imposes on our current literature. Somehow, in the end, they must live happily ever after. That's what sells a movie. A pound of flesh has been exacted for Jacob's sins. Perhaps we're not so determined to exact pounds of flesh. Perhaps you want it more than the Bible wants it. I don't know. There are many stories in the Bible which have no morals to them whatsoever. I suggested to you this story about Dina and her the attack to which she was subjected and the plunder of the two brothers and their murder of those who had attacked their sister. There's no morality here. The Bible knows it. It says as much. So what is this? Why is this precious? It's precious because it's a founding document. It's precious because it evolved. It grew. We've taken only the very rudimentary beginnings. I said we've gone in 4 weeks just to the point where Judaism begins. The Jacob stories were told long before Jewish life began. Certainly none of us would want to have our children act the way Cain acted to Abel. And certainly none of us would want our children to act the way his brothers acted to Joseph, or Joseph acted to his brothers originally. The Bible heroes are not heroes in the sense that we throw them up and say, now this is what you must be. In gentle Jesus, meek and mild, you be that somehow yourself. They're not perfect people. They're people struggling with their destiny. We recognize certain things in them, and that's all. Now, when our ancestors studied the Bible, grandfathers, grandmothers, they didn't begin as I've begun with you historically. They began with Exodus 20, with the Ten Commandments and the law. Because the thing that makes Judaism unique is its discipline, its way of life. We can laugh at the struggle between the sorcerers of Pharaoh and the sorcerers of Moses. You know, whose serpent is going to attack whom? This is ridiculous. It's more important that in the Bible legislation it says that sorcery has no place in the Jewish scheme of things. You're not to consult the person who looks at the palms or the person who has a crystal ball. I wish some of our people would believe that even in this day. But that's 3,000 years old and more in our scripture. And it's the law which made Judaism into something unique. Because we found a way to go beyond myth, beyond storytelling, and to institutionalize this new way of life. Others had some of the same ideas, but it couldn't last. With us, it did. And to be frank with you, the only reason that I began this way is that, A, we're all pretty well trained historically, and B, that literature is much more interesting than law. Law tends to be dull, law tends to be involved, and I wanted you to get a taste of the Bible, to love it, just as a book, to learn to open and read it before I got you down into more mundane things. As you saw today, the more we get into it, the more complicated it gets, and the less lift, really, we get from it. Yes? It's possible, except the Mediterranean has no tides. You know, there's a tendency to try and rationalize all miracles in the Bible. We tend to say that there were tides here, that the manna was really the excrudescence of something called a tamarisk tree, which somebody found in the Sinai Peninsula, actually gives it off a little white moss-like substance, which is, if you're dying and you've had nothing for 3 years to eat, it's edible. You remember a man named Velikovsky? A few years ago, he wrote a book to try to prove that there was actually a comet that came on the day that Moses was supposed to have held his hands up to make the sun stop in the heavens so the Jews would have a good chance to slit a few more throats of their enemies. I think that this whole attempt to make miracles reasonable is a silly one. There may be a kernel of truth at the bottom of it, but it's useless. A miracle is simply an embellishment of an historical fact, which you can't explain in natural terms, and primitive peoples believe it to have been so. Those are the two statements you need to make about it. I don't think you need to say more. We don't have to agree that the miracles took place. I believe in miracles, but not in the miracles of the Bible. Life is a miracle. Conscience is a miracle. Love is a miracle. Civilization is a miracle. The Exodus is a miracle. But not the 10 plagues, and not the Red Sea. And in fact, I wouldn't appreciate the story of the Exodus anymore if somebody could prove high and low tide, of course, which they can't, than this way. Or if they can show that the, somebody once proved at great length that the Nile, it sometimes actually looks red. And at one point, it's supposed to have turned red, one of the plagues. Because there's a certain amoebic substance which comes out on the Nile in certain years, and it gives it the look, a phosphorescent look, and makes it look red. So what? So what? It doesn't add to what the Bible is all about. Yes? You know, it's a good question. No, it would be a simple answer. But I would suggest to you that I have given you, in these 4 weeks, an interpretation of the origin of the Bible, which would largely fit into the consensus of sober academic scholarship in 1964. Now, every man who reads the Bible gets his own interpretations. I've tried consciously to filter mine out so that they don't reflect. You don't get my own mishigas in this. The Bible that I've gotten across to you is essentially what the Bible that a good biblical scholar would produce if he's trying to be as accurate as he can. Now, as far as rabbinic interpretations, it would depend upon the man's knowledge, number one, what he's after. If I wanted to teach you what Judaism, circa 1800 AD, felt about the Bible, I'd approach the Bible midrashically, which is an entirely different way. I'd examine every jot and tittle of letter for its hidden meaning. For example, the first line of the Bible is Bereshis bara Elohim et ha-shamayim ve'et ha'aretz. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, obviously, no one will disagree that you're going after the God-creator idea here. What else is involved? And here the rabbis played all kinds of interesting games. Why did the heavens come before the earth? Because man's aspiration should always be heavenward. We are of the earth, yes, but the priority is on the heavens. Does it say B'Reishit, with, in Hebrew, which means with the first God created? Well, they said that the first thing in the world is wisdom. Reishit has, in some other verse, means wisdom. God created the world with wisdom. Now, the opening of the Revelation according to John in the New Testament says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and God was the Word. That's exactly the Midrash I just gave you. And it's based on this grammatic use of Hebrew. Then they went so far, they played games. Why does the Bible begin with B? B. Why doesn't it begin with A? It's the first letter of the alphabet. Well, they answered, in class, in life, you're always ranked alphabetically. And it's not very important that your name begins with B or C or D and not A. God chose something else besides A to show you your name doesn't mean that much. They went further. I mean, every little jot and tittle. Why the B? B in Hebrew is It's an open letter. It's the only letter that opens towards the rest of the alphabet. All the other letters open up or down to the side. The lesson is, man should always be great-hearted and generous, open-minded, and so on. V in Hebrew is the same thing, except there's a dot. No dot, and B has the dot in it. Now, if I wanted to play this kind of traditional game, we've had a different Bible course, and we'd still be on Bereshis Bara Elohim. By the way, there's a wonderful interpretation. S means the direct object, and Yesh means to eat. In the beginning, God created S. In the beginning, God created eat. So you Jewish mothers are not so far off. Many men will eschew this kind of historical scalping of the Bible, because they say the crucial thing is to take the Bible simply for what you can derive out of it rather than as an historical document. I prefer it as an historical document and the other. But I don't think you'll find anybody today arguing the old direct revelation concept, except perhaps Telshi Yeshiva, this kind of approach. But that's it. That's not even an orthodox approach today. And then you get into a theological question of revelation. And that fits in with the question Henriette asked me. What happened at Sinai? Well, the Bible says what happened, that something directly was revealed. And what I said, that the Ten Commandments as we now have them were not the original Ten Commandments, would be something that some traditionalists would shy away from. But most academicians do not, and I don't know how, if we search for truth, we can blind ourselves to these facts. What's a synagogue called in Yiddish? A shul, which means a school. And learning is fundamental. If a man is studying the Talmud, according to the rabbis, and the time for prayer has come, he can keep studying the Talmud and he's fulfilled his obligation for prayer.
But only the Talmud.
No, Talmud, Midrash, anything that has to do with Torah, with learning, with Jewish learning. He's excused from public worship. The community has only enough money to build a synagogue or a schoolhouse, they must build a schoolhouse. You can worship anywhere, but you need the proper kind of surroundings for your children. Modern Jewish congregations tend to reverse the law, but this is still the basic practice of our people. Besides, what would rabbis do if one rabbi wrote the only interpretation of the Bible and none of us had our chance? Before we leave, turn this off, I'd like to read with you some material, the kind which we have not read before, purely legendary material, which I think is in many ways the original Passover Haggadah. If you turn to Exodus chapter 12, you'll see a section which we read, which is liturgic, prayer book in character, probably from the 8th or 9th centuries BC, and is the kind of literature that our forefathers used around their, I won't say their Seder tables because they didn't have a Seder table yet, around their Paschal sacrifice. The ancient practice was to, on the night of Passover, to slaughter the lamb and roast it. And then as the lamb was roasting, they sat around the fire and told the wonderful story of the Exodus and its meaning. And then as the climax of the event, they ate of the sacrifice, which was shared by all. And this was the night, the watch night, as our fathers knew it. And the children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Sukkot. about 600,000 men on foot beside children. And a mixed multitude went up also with them, in flocks and herds, and even very much cattle. Now this idea of a mixed multitude, since we're talking of Midrash, plays a very important role in Jewish thought. We've never been purist as far as blood is concerned. We have no compunctions about working with anyone, about checking their family trees. And the Jews were slaves and everybody else went up with them. And they baked unleavened cakes of the dough which they brought forth out of Egypt, for it was not leavened, because they were thrust out of Egypt and could not tarry, neither had they prepared for themselves any victual. Now the time that the children of Israel dwelt in Egypt was 430 years. And it came to pass at the end of the 430 year, even the selfsame day it came to pass, that all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. It was a Leil Shimurim, a night of watching unto the Lord for bringing them out from the land of Egypt. This same night is a night of watching unto the Lord for all the children of Israel throughout their generations. By the way, this is another one of those indications that this is all much later literature. And the Lord said unto Moses and Aaron, this is the ordinance of the Passover. There shall no alien eat thereof, but every man's servant that is bought for money, when thou hast circumcised him, then shall he eat thereof. A sojourner and a hired servant shall not eat thereof. In one house shall it be eaten. Thou shalt not carry forth aught of the flesh abroad out of the house, neither shall ye break a bone thereof. All the congregation of Israel shall keep it. And when a stranger shall sojourn with you, and will keep the Passover to the Lord, let all his males be circumcised, and let him come near and keep it. He shall be as one that is born in the land. But no uncircumcised person shall eat thereof. One law shall be to him that is homeborn, and to the stranger that sojourneth among you. Now, I would have you notice something. That verse 49 is a direct contradiction of all that comes before. That the verses before are exclusive, apartheid legislation, the Jews alone. Then you get to this strange addition. One law for the stranger and the homeborn. The Bible is arguing with itself. There was an old tradition that this was a clan experience. No one, not of the clan, could take part in this sacred meal. And sacred meals played an important part in the literature of the world, down to the Passover feast of Jesus in the Gospel stories, down to the room in which the joint meal was held in the Dead Sea Scrolls, down into a monastic practice in the Catholic Church. You joined a holy partnership, and the meal was the symbol of the joining. And none who had not gone through the initiatory rites were accepted. The Bible first reflects it, and then argues against it. Thus did all the children of Israel, as the Lord commanded Moses and Aaron, so did they. And it came to pass the selfsame day, the Lord did bring the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt by their hosts. The Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, sanctify unto me all the firstborn, whatsoever openeth the womb among the children of Israel, both of men and of beasts, it is mine. Here you get what we still have in some quarters, the custom of Pidyon HaBen. The firstborn belongs to God symbolically, and you redeem the firstborn from a priest by the paying of a symbolic token of money. And that's the way it was carried out in ancient times. But this was your tithe, in a sense, from the field, from the vineyard, from the womb itself. The first belonged to God. It goes back to the old Passover practice, which we spoke of, and explains a question. I got a call a few years ago. Rabbi, isn't it true that Jews don't eat ham? Yes. Well then, Rabbi, what's the ceremony pig in the pen? And Moses said unto the people, remember this day in which ye came out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, for by strength of hand the Lord brought you out from this place. There shall no leavened bread be eaten. This day ye go forth in the month of Abib, and it shall be, when the Lord shall bring thee into the land of the Canaanite, and the Hittite, and the Amorite, and the Hivite, and the Jebusite, which he swore unto thy fathers to give thee, the land flowing with milk and honey, that thou shalt keep this service in this month. 7 days thou shalt eat unleavened bread, and the seventh day shall be a feast to the Lord. Unleavened bread shall be eaten throughout the 7 days. There shall be no leavened bread be seen with thee. neither shall there be leaven seen with thee in all thy borders. And thou shalt tell thy son in that day, saying, It is because of that which the Lord did for me when I came forth out of Egypt. It shall be for a sign unto thee between upon thy hand, and for a memorial between thine eyes, that the Lord, law of the Lord may be in thy mouth. For with a strong hand hath the Lord brought thee out of Egypt. Thou shalt therefore keep this ordinance in its season from year to year. Here we have the reason that grandmother went through the house with a broom 2 days before Seder, looking for the last bit of leaven, put it on a bag and burnt it. And here we have the proof, really, that there were two original holidays. One, this old tribal Passover sacral holiday around the sacrifice. The other, a matzah holiday, 7 days long, which is still the practice with us today, where both these holidays have been apocryphated together. But the crucial line here, and the line I want to leave with, And thou shalt tell thy son in that day, saying, It is because of that which the Lord did for me when I came forth out of Egypt. Now, the rabbi said, isn't this grammatically an accurate sentence? I wasn't in Egypt. How can I say to my son, it was because of what the Lord did for me? Well, the crucial thing is that it was done for me, because we are the inheritors of all the spiritual anguish that went into making this book and this faith, and leaving behind the polytheism, the paganism, the sorcery, the witchcraft, which is the world in which we've been walking for a long time, coming to the civilization which we now have. Why do we read the Bible? Because it is the Bible which the Lord gave to me at Sinai or wherever else he gave it, because it has meaning and history, meaning and relevance to my own life. Now, that's it. And before you leave, I'd like to suggest something. If, as I hope, you're filled with desire to go out and read the Bible, I hope you'll do me the favor of beginning the Bible like it, as if the English Bible, as if it were a Hebrew book. The best rule I know for reading the Bible is to concentrate for the first year that you're reading it in the third of the sections of the Bible, the section that begins with the Psalms. Psalms, Proverbs, Job, Song of Songs, Ruth, Lamentations, Ecclesiastes, Esther, and so on. These are the sections of the Bible which require no historical explanation whatsoever. They're exactly what they say on the surface. The hymns are the great poems and the great prayers of our fathers. The Proverbs are the common sense wisdom of our fathers. Job is the deep philosophy of our fathers. Song of Songs is their love poetry. Lamentations is some of their elegiac poetry. Ruth is a Thomas Castaigne, the historical romance of the day. Ecclesiastes is their Stoic literature. A wise man who's lived a little bit too long and eaten a little bit too much and has a few hairs in his comments on life. Now, these parts of the Bible can and should be read, and it can be read without any kind of direction save your own good, clear eyesight. Read them first, and you'll see what the faith of the Bible led into. And then as we come through our tortuous, snail-paced way down through the midst of prehistory and into Jewish history, and see how this thing was put together and what they fought against and what they managed to wrench out of the blackness around them, I think you will gradually come together at a midpoint, perhaps in the prophets. You have gotten a good background in the Bible, and I hope that together we have gotten a good background as to its historical setting. Well, thank you very much.